Greetings and welcome to Grund Podcast, a thing that you listen if you like adventure games, art, literature, music, game dev, and everything in between. Our today's guest is Johan Torresson from Raw Fury. Why? Because he struck me as an open and friendly dude without any unnecessary theater around him. So we chat about simple things really, including how to start your journey with Harry Potter and end up at the black metal concert. On the podcast side of things, I try to talk more coherently and now try to clean up things audio-wise a bit better as well. And don't forget, Grund is surreal, sci-fi, narrative-driven adventure game where your choices matter. Follow us on Twitter, other way less usable stuff, join our Discord. All links you can find in show notes and on grund.com. Also, we have a Kickstarter preview page up and running. Smash that notify button and like and subscribe even if that's not an option there. Ha ha ha. Off we go. Off we go. Off we go.
Morning.
Morning. So let's start with your day because it's morning. Probably there is no set in stone pattern, but still, how much time do you spend reading pitches, playing demos, being on Twitter? What's your day like?
My day is usually waking up, seeing what's new internally in our comms chats and so on to make sure that I'm up to speed with what's going on in the company, since I'm not on location in Stockholm where most of the people are. So just getting up to speed. That usually happens like, you know, when I'm in bed. If I wake up before my kid does, I'll just grab my phone and check out what's new. Then on a normal day when everything else is fine, the majority of my time goes into going through the Asana board where we have the pitches that go into to the Magic at Raw Fury email, and playing, reviewing, and finding stuff that I find interesting and getting other people to look at it and give their inputs. Twitter is more of a low-key kind of in-between things.
I'm always wondering that people have time to find things on Twitter, retweet them, have a chat in like 10-20 conversations at once. It's like, it's a magic for me.
Yeah, no, I mean I do that occasionally, but most of the time I'm lurking, or like I have some dumb fucking tweet that I want to get out, and I put that out, and then I spend some time just checking, you know, what games are being dropped around, and if it's like if I'm sitting on Twitter to specifically look for games, I'm usually going through the normal tags, right? The indie dev, the screenshot Saturday, those kind of things.
So you're saying they actually work, those tags?
I mean, it depends. It's pretty rare that I find something I haven't heard or seen about before that I'm interested in, but it can definitely work out. Often, you know, the more popular ones have already popped up in my feed a couple of times, so I'm usually looking at the other stuff, you know, trying to figure out what's not being appreciated and what's like the hidden gems.
One thing you said is unbelievable, though. You said that you wake up faster than your kids. How's that?
Yeah.
How's that possible?
I mean, it's we both wake up pretty early, like at 5:30. Now there's gonna be some noise here, so I'm gonna sneak past this truck. I bet this is going to sound great.
That's life. So let's get back to your profession. For example, have you people who don't play games? What are the their thoughts about game industry per se? Probably you've heard some wild stories, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty. I mean, lots of people play games, but not necessarily everyone has an understanding of how games are made or how they get funded or why they blow up or and so on. Like, it's most of us only touch the end result, right?
Exactly.
So if there's anything, it's like people think that games magically appear.
Someone
gets an idea and then that's enough, and then people fiddle around with something and get people to rally, and then it's a game made, and the process is usually much more not necessarily complicated, but like just strenuous. There's just so much more work going into stuff that people are like, oh, this is just a fucking blah 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 blah. This is like, oh, you could pull this off in a month, blah 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 blah. And that's usually just because people lack the technical knowledge.
Sure. Let's switch then to actual developers. What are, maybe you've seen the misconceptions the developers have when they're pitching the game? When you see something and like, wow, dude, you shouldn't do that. And what are the no-nos?
Depends on the setting, right? A lot of the time, if you're pitching live, so to speak, or pitching in a setting where you're sitting in front of someone, be it on Zoom or be it somewhere else in the physical space as well. A lot of the time, people come in with, you know, to a 15 or 30 minute long meeting with 25 slides and tons of stuff to talk about. And then it becomes more of a, you know, I'll read my PDF to you,
mm-hmm.
and then we can watch a video. And that's a waste of time for most people.
Sure.
You can just send me the fucking pitch documents before. And then we can talk about the pitch rather than you spending, you know, 70% of the time telling me about it.
Switching pages.
I read faster than you speak anyways. So I will be reading the pitch as you pitch it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be like the time we could have spent talking about what's in there rather than you just telling me what I've already read a second ago. It's not beneficial for a developer or me. I mean, it's always better if I have, like, if I can play the build before we have the pitch, that's even better. Most of the time, you know, I can't think of any game that I've signed that has been like in a meeting and someone shows me something and I go, yeah, this is, we're signing this right now. Because it's like, I need to play it anyways, and the feedback you can get from my live situation, if you're just pitching it, I can feedback on your pitching technique, but I would rather feedback on the game, the plan, you know, all that stuff.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, we kind of drifted into my next question, which is a bit airy, if I can say so. How big of a role there is for a hunch in your professional life and life in general? I'm speaking about David Lynch have even a book about it, Catching a Fish.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I mean, he's pretty spot on. But I mean, it's also like a hunch is so. People define it in weird ways, right? But for me, a hunch is just a collective of non-conscious processes coming together and telling me something. And that those non-conscious processes are, you know, the sum of my experience, the sum of what I've seen so far, the sum of what I've read, thought, my preferences in media and art, and all these things kind of just forming some fucking ur-mass of some sort. So that everything gets deep. Like, I obviously look at things and I think about it from a formal way as well, but the informal way has equal amounts of say.
Yeah, it's like an initial push, and then you can see the numbers and whatnot.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, we don't even, like, I don't even do a formal, like, is this something that can, is this financially viable? I don't do that before I have more people than me liking what I have in front of me. Because if it doesn't matter if it's like, oh, this is going to be a smash hit, big seller, whoa, 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 whoa. If no one feels like they want to work on it, or enough people feel like they want to work on it. Like, well, I need the team okay first.
Mm-hmm. Well, many people, I think many people are, well, it looks like to me that you're kind of down to earth person when you're talking to developers, to journalists, and whatnot. So, is there some trends you kind of dislike today in a development space, in the big grand picture?
I mean, I'm not. It's a funny thing because, like, I don't like trends at all necessarily, because it's like if I look at what's trending now and I start looking for stuff that can overlap with those trends. I mean, I'm usually living 18 to 36 months in the future, right?
Wow,
I'm looking at what's coming out at that time, and I'm trying to figure out, like, if I'm trying to find a trend, I'm trying to find a trend that doesn't exist yet, right? Just trying to see kind of like where things are headed. But those things really only come into fruition if like, you know, if we like what we see, if we like what we're playing, it doesn't matter if there's a current trend or if there's a possibility to be a later trend.
And what about behavioral trends?
Oh, well, you know, I'm, you know, not keen on predatory monetization stuff, but that's been the case for the last 10 years, right?
How do you view mobile space today? It's probably, I think, but I am not into that, but it feels like that's where the most sharks are, the most vicious ones.
I mean, and you kind of have to, because there's so tough margins. We don't really do that type of mobile stuff, right? We have some titles that have come out on mobile, but they're premium titles, and that's a very different, that's a different mobile space. Like it's when you look at mobile for scale and for mass consumption where it gets kind of
scary, actually.
It gets very really reliant on KPIs and just ruthless fucking monetization adjustments, and we don't do that, so
cool.
I don't have to care.
Switching a little bit back on the pitching side of things, for me, when someone mentions family, it's a red flag. I thought, oh, fuck. What are the red flags when you hear, when you talk with the developers?
No, I mean, a word on the family stuff. I think it really depends on the context. Like, I view the work we do as partnerships. Some people will describe it as family. I think partnerships is, it's a more equal term because it's a, you know, mutually beneficial thing. And while we don't work with people that we think are assholes, family is implies some sort of loyalty beyond the partnerships. And we, you know, we try to do our best, but I don't want to suck someone in with that stuff. I know that's, you know, I think Rolf Jure uses it occasionally to describe the feeling of working with us. I personally don't, because I prefer the term partnership. As you say, like the term family has become a bit weird lately, in the last 5 years or so.
Maybe especially more, when you use it in the first couple sentences when you meet the people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tool, I guess. But what we're looking for is like an equal partnership, right? Where we are both in the same boat together and moving forwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I get people using the term because it's like so prevalent. Red flags for me is more like, you know, obviously shithead behavior is always a red flag. Someone's being an absolute ass, I don't want to work with them. But more commonly, it's discrepancy between what the developer is telling me that they're doing and what the build they're sending me is doing. If I feel like they don't know what they're building, or they don't understand what they're building, or if they're unable to communicate what they're building in a way that person outside of their team can understand it, that can be a little bit worrying. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily need to be a red flag, but it's definitely something where like we have to go into this and figure it out before we can move forward.
Have a chat.
Yeah. I mean, most things that are not like, this person is a fucking racist. most things that it's not that can usually be like, you know, misunderstandings or language or cultural barriers or whatnot. And that can be sorted if you just talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually what I do.
Okay.
Trying to figure out what the fuck is going on.
A bit of off record. Was there any red flags about Grund, if you remember?
Not in terms of that stuff. There was no weirdness in the pitch or anything like that.
No dick pics.
No, none of that. In that case, it was more that when we do review everything, we need to have, you know, the whole team has to kind of gather behind the idea and be excited about it. And I was pretty excited. I think it's an interesting project. But some others felt like either they were unfazed or they didn't really get into it.
That's life.
That was more the case.
I want to touch a bit adventure games since I'm making one.
Yeah.
In a couple conversations here and there, I heard the opinion that they need to evolve now. It's a time to evolve, to stray away from the formula of classic points and clicks. What would be your take if you have any on that?
I mean, like evolution for evolution's sake can feel kind of forced, I guess, but being smart about design means, you know, understanding what was good and what is good and how those kind of communicate now. You know, if you look at something that like Disco Elysium, there's tons of old school stuff going on, but it's reformulated or repackaged in a way that makes it feel very, very fresh and interesting. But there's also a ton of more classic style things, right? If you look at Whispers of the Machine, for example, it's pretty traditional in many ways, in the way it looks from a design standpoint, but it also offers a lot of like small tweaks and interesting innovations in how there's multiple paths to solve certain puzzles. There's ways to express your character. It's not locked in that sense. Same with Backbone, like multiple path solutions and so on. That can be interesting.
So the word of the answer would be could be fusion.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent. I think it's more just like realizing that some things in the past were hard because there wasn't enough knowledge about it design-wise. The people I work kind of still working things out. A lot of the stuff that I love and that I grew up with were pretty early things, right?
Sure.
And part of it was just like limitations. What do you mean? I mean, if you don't... Design is kind of a language, right? So if you don't have the words and the vocabulary, it becomes hard to describe a thing. And over time, the vocabulary has increased. And so the design opportunities and design possibilities increase as well. I mean, the technical limitations is pretty much
non-existent.
Gone. Yeah. Right. So now instead of having like, you know, we can only put this many floppies out. So we can only have this amount of text and this amount of art and this amount of this and that. And those limitations are pretty much gone. Like, if you can have a 50 gigabyte update to Call of Duty, you know, take Curse of Monkey Island or something and just add, instead of having that be like 600 megabytes or 400 megabytes or whatever the fuck it was, you know, 10 times that size, uh-huh. There's so much stuff you could cram in there.
About the size, though.
Yep.
I don't remember where I read it. Of course, there was an opinion that nowadays big studios use graphical fidelity just as a money dump, and that's why they don't actually try to evolve and bring something new gameplay wise. Would you agree to that one?
I think that's very depends extremely much on like the different projects, but there's been a certain amount of streamlining going on for sure. Just as it is with pop music and whatnot, there's innovations going on as well. Some of them under the hood, some of them in the design, some of them in the presentation. So I would never say that in like changes doesn't happen, but with the restrictions kind of going away, it relies more on the skills and work of the people making it to find interesting ways to do new things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's, you know, we built the Snowdrop engine, we're pushing this trailer out for The Division and people are shooting, and then you see the cop car that they're hiding behind, and some bullets hit the tires and the car lowers itself because the air is going out of the tire. And that was, you know, pretty cool in a technical way at the time, because it shows a reactivity in the environment that maybe wasn't common before. And that's something you can play around with. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make a game, right? That's sure. Just another tool.
Back to adventure games a bit, as a last question. When you try to do something new, you always worry that people won't understand you. What are your thoughts about how evolved the player is?
Players are probably smarter than what people think, but they're a lot of people that play are also, as in anything else, you know, creatures of habit. You know, if you go to a death metal concert and the band that's opening the show is a you know, I don't know, fucking trap group or something, or a country group, there might be pushback because it's like, oh, this is out of my comfort zone, I came for the death metal, what the fuck is this? Even if there's thematic overlap or other overlaps in other areas, then then it might still put people off. If you look at artists like Chelsea Wolfe, for example, she's super popular in the metal community, especially in the more extreme stuff. But her music is not necessarily abrasive in the same way. She's more like a, you know, it's not pop exactly, but it's like you can listen to it. It's clean singing and so on. But the thematic and the aesthetic vibe of the music and the lyrics and so on is pretty gnarly.
I actually totally agree with you here because, for example, only through death metal, I started with thrash, then death, and then black. And through black, I actually discovered Southern Gothic music, which is totally different. But the vibe is there. Yeah. Everything is there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of that, right? I mean, I came into not radio pop music, but, you know, indie pop music and kind of that ilk through black metal as well. Like finding black metal bands that were pretty avant-garde and like incorporating melodies and themes that were also frequent in pretty sad pop music. I mean, I don't think you could put together, say, if you look at Danny Brown, for example, with his album The Atrocity Exhibition, which is like a couple of years old now, super, super good rap album. But thematically, it's pretty fucking destitute and gnarly and just like overall depressing themes. They go, you know, it's drug addiction, it's a lot of just depressive shit going on. And then you look at a band like, say, Life Lover or Shastur or something like that, or Primitive Man is probably a good overlap, which is like a sludgy, like black death kind of sludge doom, fuck, you know, every sort of that genre, like very, very slow, extremely abrasive, lots of like noise and harsh noise inspiration. But thematically, there's a big overlap in how they talk about race and class and economics and drug abuse and so on. So finding a way to kind of see past that, I think players definitely have the ability to do the same, but you kind of have to guide them, like help them find the points of interests that do overlap.
When do they feel where they feel safe, and then you just push them a bit further. I mean,
it's like, you know, you bring them into something, and then you slowly branch out. It's like when you have a friend that reads, say, you know, I don't know, like a fucking Harry Potter book or something, and then you can turn them from Harry Potter into some maybe harder fantasy or more
Witcher,
more gloomy shit like that. And then when you can find the overlap between those things, you can go into Dostoevsky, and from Dostoevsky, you can pretty much go anywhere, you know, but Kafka, Camus comes pretty easy from that. And if you have Kafka and Camus down, then you can start reading a bunch of, you know, weird philosophy. You can start reading Ligotti, you can start reading Emile Cioran, you can start reading... what the fuck is his name? There's a guy that wrote a book about like the better never to have been, The Trouble with Being Born, which is like an anti-natalism treatise. And, you know, suddenly you've gone from Harry Potter into the territory that not only was humanity a mistake, we should actively look to eradicate ourselves in some way by refusing to breed.
That's a good turn.
Actually, yeah, and it's a pretty long leap, but you can get there, right? You just need to find the inflection points or find the vectors of interest and just, like, you know, tie it together in a way that's interesting.
Yeah, I was one of the fans wrote me one day that my work reminds him of Ligotti, so it was a big compliment. Yeah. And we have actually Darkthrone Easter egg in demo. Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff, right? I mean, I put a Darkthrone Easter egg into the Norco announcements. You know, a blaze in the southern sky was the announcement for Norco, which is obviously a joke and a nod to the blaze in the northern sky record that came out like 91.
Okay, still good. Okay.
Yeah,
no. Man, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
And I'm really sorry for my spoken English is really bad because I don't have a lot of practice you see I'm losing the sentences here.
No, I think you're doing great. I don't worry, like there's not been anything that I've got strung up on. I mean, English is not my first language either, so I know the struggle of just like being in a meeting or in a call or something, and then it's like, oh fuck, I know 7 words in Swedish that would fit here, but I can't find the single English one I know.
Cool. Thank you for being so open and
happy to.
Your rarity, I think. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you for taking the time to chat with me. It's always nice.
You know, I have some egoistic aims for this. So.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone has for everything at some point anyway, so that's fine.
Yeah, since I'm bad at goodbyes, I just cut him off. Kidding. But here you are. I hope you enjoyed this chat and see you next time. Bye!